Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to the Metabolic Classroom, a nutrition and lifestyle podcast focused on the truth behind why we get sick and fat. What you're about to hear was taken from a live broadcast streamed on insuliniq.com.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being a member of the Insulin IQ community. And in particular, thank you for joining me for this week's Metabolic Classroom. That is a title that I've always been particularly pleased with, this idea. Thanks again. So today, the focus of the classroom today is to help you better understand the origins of insulin resistance. Last time, and if you haven't, make sure you go back and watch that episode, we discussed what insulin resistance is. So we really defined it, particularly in the context of metabolic health. And different ways of defining metabolic health, including metabolic syndrome and metabolic flexibility, and then actually revealing, pulling back the curtain and showing you that really at the heart of both of those problems is insulin resistance. So we explained the scope of the problem and why it matters. And why it matters in particular, that idea is something we'll focus on more next week. Before we get started, I kind of like making it a habit of sharing with you guys a little piece of some newly published research. There was a paper that was published just recently in the journal Cell Reports. And what's interesting about this is that it shows this, to invoke a concept of economics, this diminishing returns when it comes to satiety and our consumption of sweet things. So the study utilized rats. I know of no evidence in humans to support or refute this. So for now, we'll assume it's relevant in humans until we learn otherwise. But they fed the rats a diet that had high levels of sugar in the water. Now, of course, that's how a lot of people get sugar, right? Any of these sugary sodas or even juice has a lot of sugar in it. And so they had the animals drinking the sugar water. And then they tested the animal's response to a load of glucose. So then gave them a bunch of glucose to eat. And they found that before they had started this high sugar diet, the high sucrose, they had a very substantial response to the glucose. And it induced a sense of satiety. In other words, they got the glucose load and they felt really full. However, with this sugar diet, with the diet that was higher in sugar, it didn't work as well. When they gave the animals this load of carbohydrate, they didn't have that same degree of satiety. That signal, that sensitivity to the carbohydrate load had been diminished. Now, they're not using the word insulin resistance there, and I'm not going to either. They didn't really test it. But I will just say they found that there was a diminished ability to sense the calories or the energy coming from that carbohydrate, and the animals would have been inclined to just continue to eat more. All right. So that's a little bit of the science corner of the metabolic classroom. Now let's get into the actual meat of the lecture, if you will, the classroom session for today. So where does insulin resistance come from? Just as a reminder, insulin resistance is the single most common health problem worldwide. So it is worth talking about. It is worth devoting a career to understanding and just appreciating in our life and at a global level. All right. So I have classified, in my understanding and my exploration and study of insulin resistance, really two categories when it comes to understanding the causes of insulin resistance. And I use the terms primary and secondary. Now, the primary insulin resistance is a term that I use very specifically. In fact, both of these terms are very specific. With primary, I consider the cause to meet that to fall into that category, if it is based on research that has been confirmed in all three commonly used biomedical research models. Now, what do I mean by that? As a biomedical scientist, I will use and have, in fact, published papers on all of this, three models or three ways of doing experiments. At the kind of simplest, it is just growing cells in a little petri dish, in a lab. So we have a little incubator that will grow cells. We'll put muscle cells on the petri dish, or liver cells, or neurons, or fat cells. And then we do experiments on those cells. Next, you can do experiments in a whole organism, like in the case of laboratory rodents. So this is mice or rats, where you can knock out genes or overexpress genes. And then you can get all of the tissue to study the fat and the heart and the brain, stuff that you just couldn't get from humans, of course, in a perfectly controlled environment in the lab. And then next is experiments done in humans. So these are the three commonly used biomedical models: cells, rodents, humans. So the primary causes of insulin resistance are those noxious stimuli that have been shown to cause insulin resistance in all three of those models. The secondary causes of insulin resistance that I'll share with you are those that maybe have been shown to cause insulin resistance in two of the three, as we will highlight one particular example of that. Or it is actually, there's evidence to support all three, but it causes the insulin resistance by taking advantage of one of the primary causes. So it's not independent of the primary cause. I hope that makes sense. So that would count it as a secondary cause. Again, if it requires the involvement of one of the primary causes, so it's still coming back to the primary, that if you eliminate the primary, then you've eliminated the insulin resistance. But again, with the three primary causes that I'll talk about in a moment, each of them is capable of causing insulin resistance on their own. All right, now let's go through the three primary causes. These are the big pillars that really contributes to insulin resistance in cells, rodents, and humans. First one is inflammation. This is one that I feel pretty strongly about and I'm quite familiar with because it was largely the focus of my postdoctoral fellowship research many, many years ago and work that I had continued and have since then and continue to contribute to now. So in this case of the inflammation, it's important for you to appreciate that when I say inflammation, I don't mean an immune response. And I don't mean an angry, red, oozing scratch on your arm that's gotten infected. When I say inflammation, I actually just want you to think that of a pathway within virtually every cell of the body. And that when this pathway is activated, it is part of a if we were talking about an immune cell, it would be part of a normal immune response. But for example, muscle cells have an inflammatory pathway or multiple, and those aren't immune cells. Fat cells have an inflammatory pathway, and those aren't immune cells. Those aren't white blood cells that are part of an immune response to defend the body against infection. But all of these cells have these inflammatory pathways. And what's interesting in the muscle, for example, that you activate the inflammatory pathway and the muscle isn't going to start producing antibodies, but it actually then shows this intersection of the immune system or the inflammatory system and the metabolic system. So anytime you activate inflammatory pathways within a cell, you cause that cell to have a diminished response to insulin resistance. So at a cell level, you can just incubate cells with an inflammatory protein, like, for example, C-reactive protein. Have you heard of that? Does that one sound familiar? CRP, or C-reactive protein, is a protein that has been increasingly measured in clinical tests because it's such a good marker of inflammation and just overall cardiometabolic health. So if I have muscle cells or fat cells or liver cells or brain cells, and I put C-reactive protein in that little culture bath with the cells, and then I test how the cells respond to insulin, it will be diminished. The insulin response will be turned down. Same thing goes for animals. If you induce an inflammatory response in animals, they become demonstrably insulin resistant. And the same thing happens in humans. In fact, it has been fascinating for me to notice during this period of time over the last few years where everyone's much more mindful of their immune health, that people, and at the same time, people are wearing more continuous glucose monitors. It's been interesting to see how people can almost predict that they have a cold or a flu coming on because they notice that their blood glucose levels start to climb and get more variable, a general sign of insulin resistance. And indeed, that is the case. In humans, if you induce an immune response, the body will become more insulin resistant if you activate those inflammatory pathways. In fact, there's some fascinating publications that have touched on this before that have looked at rheumatoid arthritis. Like every autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis has an ebb and a flow to it. It will have periods of time where it's really active and aggressive and painful, and other periods of time where it starts to retreat and settles down a little bit. You can actually track the insulin resistance that goes with it, that as the body is activating an immune response, insulin resistance goes with it. So to sum all of that up, inflammation is, we could call, the first primary cause of insulin resistance. Now, unrelated to insulin resistance is stress. Now, stress is a big term. It's a kind of blanket term that within pop culture has taken on a lot of dimensions that are sometimes used inappropriately and other times precisely. So with stress, this is when I say stress, I really mean the stress hormones. I can't help but think about stress as a hormone response or an endocrine situation. And specifically, there are two primary stress hormones in the body: cortisol and epinephrine, also known as adrenaline. I'll call it epinephrine. That's the more technical term that's used. So cortisol and epinephrine. These hormones are actually totally unrelated. They are produced in different cell types. They're produced very differently. They're very different types of hormones. They move through the blood in different ways. They actually act on different cells throughout the body in different ways and have different effects throughout the body. The one thing they have in common is that they both want to increase blood glucose. And so if you have these stress hormones that are trying to push glucose up, there's another hormone that now has to work even harder to bring the glucose down. And of course, that's insulin. And so it's no surprise then that if these stress hormones are continually pushing up the glucose, the body's becoming more insulin resistant. Now, what are some of the causes of stress? This can be something as benign as sleep deprivation and insomnia. One bad night of sleep will significantly increase cortisol the next day, which causes insulin resistance that next day. Now, thankfully, one good night of sleep wipes that all out. But sleep deprivation is a simple and very common cause of stress on the body, which has a metabolic consequence. Similarly, for example, if we drink, there are even more seemingly benign things, but tragic when you couple it with the poor sleep, which is excessive caffeine consumption. That if someone's taking in too much caffeine, perhaps to try to make up for their or to feel better with the lack of sleep, then that increases the other stress hormone, the epinephrine. And when epinephrine goes up now, it's trying to push up glucose, which then makes insulin work harder. And so it's easy to see how a person can fall into this vicious cycle of sleeping poorly, taking caffeine to make up for it, which just continues to drive this insulin resistance. And again, this is something that happens in humans. You give humans a load of cortisol or cortisol-like molecule, give them epinephrine, and then try to treat them with insulin. They'll need much more insulin to bring their glucose down to what would have been just a modest amount of insulin prior to the introduction of the stress hormones. Same with animals and same with cells. Having done those experiments myself, you treat the cells with those molecules and they become insulin resistant. Now, the third and final of the primary causes, I leave in the final pole position, if you will, in order to just really emphasize it, because it's the one that I believe is over time, chronically, the most relevant of all of them. And that is chronically elevated insulin. Now, let me just introduce a brief tangent where some people will say, or they'll want to think that I'm saying any insulin spike is bad and should be avoided at all costs. That's not what I'm saying. But I want someone to appreciate the impact of multiple insulin spikes that are stacked together. Now, to elaborate on that, if someone eats a load of carbohydrate, because protein and fat are generally going to have elicit no insulin response, if someone eats pure carbohydrate, insulin will come up, and the insulin will take usually about 2 hours to come back down. In an insulin-sensitive person, maybe between 2 and 3 hours until the insulin comes back down to normal. Now, remember, the reason I'm talking about this is because too much insulin causes insulin resistance. You can do this in humans, you can do this in rodents and in cells. And I've done it in, not in humans, but others have, give humans an infusion of insulin and then give them a few hours and the insulin starts working worse and worse and worse. So it's increasingly resistant, the body is, to it. So you have the person who gets an insulin response to a carbohydrate load. Unfortunately, the average person not only eats a very starchy, sugary breakfast, but they do the same thing with a mid-morning snack. And so right around the time insulin's about to come back down to its fasted levels, we have a culture of incessant snacking and eating. They spike it right back up. Then they spike it right back up and they do it again. They do it for lunch. They do it for an afternoon snack. They do it for dinner. They do it for their evening snack. So every waking moment is spent in
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In a state of elevated insulin. Elevated insulin causes insulin resistance. The nice thing about all three of those primary causes, and this is an upcoming topic before the end of the month of about how to resolve insulin resistance, but I'm sort of getting a little bit ahead of myself. It is that of all three of these primary causes, again, inflammation, stress, and elevated insulin, it's the elevated insulin that can be corrected so quickly. For example, if you had someone who you were a clinician or you're talking to a loved one and you found out that they had all of those things, high stress, high inflammation, high insulin, you would say, hey, your stress is high. You need to lower your stress hormones. Well, you don't know exactly how they're doing it. Or maybe you know that they're sleeping poorly and you say, I know you're insomniac. You have insomnia. You're not sleeping well, you need to sleep better. And they're going to say, oh, thanks. Now I'm going to be stressed even more than I was before about my lack of sleep. And so it's difficult to really get a firm grasp on stress to turn it down. Same with inflammation, that if someone has an elevated C-reactive protein, for example, knowing how to reduce that can be a little tricky. They might not know. It might not be something that they're even doing in their lifestyle. It could be a result of their fat cells, which I'll get to in just a moment. But insulin, we know what spikes insulin. And so it becomes a lever that we can grab, whereas the other two are slippery and it's difficult to grab them. This one, we can grab it and immediately start pulling it down within a day, improving insulin resistance as a result. So those are the three primary causes. Now let's go on where, again, just to reiterate, we have evidence, multiple publications across all three commonly used biomedical models, that these are all on their own capable of causing insulin resistance. Now, some of you may be thinking that there are some conspicuously absent causes here. For example, why haven't I mentioned seed oils? Well, now I will. Let's transition from the primary causes to the secondary causes. And I speak about seed oils with enormous respect, in all sincerity. The amount of papers I've now been introduced to, despite not being an expert on seed oils, is remarkable. And these are definitely contributing to diseases across the board. I just, of course, focus on my area of expertise, namely insulin resistance. There is evidence in cell cultures that linoleic acid, the primary omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid that constitutes linoleic acid, that constitutes soybean oil and the other refined seed oils, that in cells, it can cause insulin resistance. Kind of. There's mixed evidence there. Next, in animals, if you have an animal eat a high, animals will eat a high soybean oil diet as opposed to, say, coconut oil, the soybean oil diet consumers will get more insulin resistant than the coconut oil. So there's something more uniquely pathogenic. But in humans, I've just never seen a study in humans where you have the person eat soybean oil specifically, independent of any other types of fats, and then they become insulin resistant. That's why I haven't quite been able to graduate seed oils into the primary cause. I believe it's contributing. In fact, I'll mention a reason that it might be a bit indirect in a moment with regards to fat cells. But the direct effect of just eating the linoleic acid, do you get it? Do you get the insulin resistance? No. No, I've not seen the studies on that. But again, I'll revisit that in just a moment. All right. Now, the other secondary cause of just two that I'm going to mention, and then I'll mention the last one, which is very unique, is uric acid. Thanks in large part to my good friend Rick Johnson at the University of Colorado, the world has really woken up to the dangers of uric acid. And just as a reminder, as much as the world has focused on meat as a sole cause of uric acid because of some of the unique molecules within it, fructose will increase uric acid far more than any amount of meat will. And that's primarily what Rick is focused on, this fructose. Every time you metabolize a molecule of fructose, you're producing some uric acid. So it's a heavy, heavy contributor. Now, interestingly, uric acid has been shown to cause insulin resistance in all three biomedical models. You treat cells with uric acid, they become insulin resistant. You increase the uric acid in the animals, they become insulin resistant. If you block uric acid production, they don't become insulin resistant. And the exact same thing is seen with humans. More uric acid, as you spike it up, more insulin resistance. You block uric acid production, insulin resistance gets better. It's pretty robust evidence. Now, why don't I put it in the category of primary? Because if you block the inflammation effect of the uric acid, there's no insulin resistance, or you wipe it out. And so this is the case that I alluded to earlier, where you have a trigger, a stimulus, but it is acting through another mediator. And that if you take away this mediator, so it's dependent on specifically inflammation. And in the absence of inflammation, there's no insulin resistance. So it's dependent. So uric acid causes insulin resistance dependent on its ability to increase inflammation or activate these immune path, these inflammatory pathways. That's why I put it in the secondary realm. Because remember, with the primary, all of those are capable of causing insulin resistance on their own in the absence of any other signal. They're not dependent on anything but themselves. Now, in all of these, what all of these have in common is that they will manifest with all the signs of insulin resistance. And remember, there are two real aspects. It's the coin analogy, where you will have cells that aren't responding well to insulin, and in the whole body, insulin levels will be elevated, which makes the elevated insulin cause of insulin resistance particularly vicious, because if elevated insulin is a cause of insulin resistance, which is then causing more elevated insulin, which then contributes to further insulin resistance. You can see how this becomes a positive feedback and a vicious cycle. So the last one that is totally unique is starvation. Now, I need to define that term because too often people will think of starvation as just fasting. No, there's a big divide between fasting and starvation. In fact, that divide is something we can pinch and jiggle, namely our body fat. That if you have body fat to burn, this is a topic for another time, so I'll be a little sparse on it, then you're fasting. The moment you are restricting calories and you've run out of fat, now you're burning your lean mass. You're burning muscle for energy in particular, and even bone and everything else. You'll start eating away at your body to just continue to make enough energy for the brain to survive. And in that state, the body becomes very insulin resistant, which is primarily, interestingly, a stress response. But it's unlike the earlier stress response that I spoke about, because in this instance where the body is wasting away, you are insulin resistant, but insulin levels are low. The body can't afford to keep insulin high, because if insulin's high, then the body is attempting to store energy, which would deprive the brain, because the brain can't handle a state if energy is just being stored, because it doesn't store energy. It needs to be pulling it from the blood. We'll revisit this idea when we talk about the metabolic origins of Alzheimer's disease in an upcoming lesson. But nevertheless, just to reiterate this unique metabolic state, starvation is insulin resistance through stress hormones, but it's unique because insulin levels are low. And any other instance of insulin resistance that I'm aware of, and I think I'm aware of all of them, insulin will be elevated if the body has insulin resistance, including physiological insulin resistance. And we'll talk about that at a future time. All right, now let's move on to a next sort of segment as I wind up the lecture classroom part of this before we do some Q&A. All of these stimuli that I've talked about are direct effects. If you directly increase inflammation due to illness, for example, or a food sensitivity, the body becomes insulin resistant. But if you remove that stimulus, they're insulin sensitive. Same with stress, same with elevated insulin. So these are direct effects, direct noxious stimuli causing insulin resistance. But there's a more creeping version of insulin resistance, which now brings us back to the fat cell. There are multiple theories of which tissue of the body becomes insulin resistant first. Some will say that it is the muscle that becomes insulin resistant first. Some will say that it's the liver. Others will say that it's the fat cells. Anyone who says it's other than the fat cells is totally wrong. Now, I expect they'd say the same thing about me, but I'm right. Fat cells are the beginning. That is the first domino to fall. You know probably by now of my affection for alliteration, fat falls first when it comes to insulin resistance. So what makes the fat cell get big? This is actually a topic that I just spoke at a recent meeting, a low-carb meeting in the upcoming Metabolic Health Summit at the time I'm recording this. And I will post this lecture at a future point on the Insulin IQ site. But it's basically, the name of that is Shrinking Fat Cells, Energy versus Insulin. And so when a fat cell starts to grow, that's a process called hypertrophy. And as the fat cell continues to grow, it starts to experience two problems. First, it can't grow anymore. It's actually reaching the limit that the cell membrane can hold together. It's like a water balloon that's getting so full that it's about to burst. It's going to pop, and then everyone gets messy and we get water all over the house. Now, one solution, let's just stick with the analogy, comparing the fat cell to a water balloon. If we can't disconnect the balloon to the tap that is filling the balloon, what if we could just poke a small little hole in the balloon without popping the whole balloon? Now it's starting to leak out some of the water to match the fat that's coming in. That's really analogous to what's happening with the fat cell as it gets too big. Insulin is continually telling it to grow, mostly by inhibiting its ability to release the fat, but also by force feeding it. And so the fat cell basically says, insulin, you're not letting me break down this fat. I'm not listening to you anymore. And so I'm going to become insulin resistant. And so it becomes insulin resistant to stop growing. This is why people on average, can't limitlessly get fat. There is this point beyond which they can't get any fatter. Now, there are some exceptions where some people genetically have the ability to make new fat cells. They can multiply their fat cells. Those are people who can continue to get fat, but that's uncommon. So the big fat cell, the hypertrophic fat cell, becomes insulin resistant to stop future growth. Second, as it gets so big, it starts to get pushed further and further away from capillaries, which is the essential blood vessel where a cell gets all of its oxygen and all of its nutrients and then dumps all of its waste products into the blood to be eliminated from the body through the kidneys or the liver or the breath in some instances like CO2. So it's the capillary. And so the fat cell that's getting so big is getting pushed too far from the capillary. And that becomes what's called hypoxic. In other words, it's running out of oxygen. And one response to that, the fat cell is saying, hey, I'm suffocating here. It will start releasing pro-inflammatory proteins, what are called cytokines. Now, through the body, this begins to turn on all of those inflammatory pathways that will then cause insulin resistance. But at the level of the fat cell, one effect of one of these pro-inflammatory proteins will be to tell the capillaries to start making new capillaries. So it will increase the vascularization of the fat cell, helping it start to breathe better. It can get oxygen again. But again, a consequence is that it's spilling the inflammatory proteins throughout the body. Now, what is it that makes the fat cell get big? There are two essential elements to this. You cannot have one without the other in the whole body. It is impossible. And again, you'll have to watch the talk in the future in order to understand it. So you must have an elevated insulin level to signal to the fat cell that it needs to grow. That's the stimulus telling the fat cell, grow. And then you must have sufficient energy or enough calories available to fuel that growth. I hope that you can appreciate the difference. A fat cell that is swimming in a sea of calories in the absence of insulin will not store any of those calories. It is totally, completely, physically impossible for a fat cell to not only grow, but even stay big if insulin is low. It cannot hold on to its energy. So you need an insulin stimulus and you need sufficient energy to fuel that stimulus to grow. Now you have a hypertrophic or fat cell, and then you have this kind of more creeping insidious version of insulin resistance that, you know, that's sort of settling in over time as the person's gaining this weight in a unique way by making the fat cells get big. So that is the sort of final sentiment here. Now, one other point where I mentioned I would bring back the soybean oil or the linoleic acid. Linoleic acid contributes to insulin resistance in part through this fat cell effect, because linoleic acid will inhibit the fat cell's ability to multiply. And so as the fat tissue, elevated insulin, sufficient energy, is being told and fueled to grow, if there's linoleic acid coming in, it accumulates in the fat cell, converts, becomes this other molecule called 4-HNE, 4-hydroxynonenal, 4-HNE. And 4-HNE will basically dictate to the fat tissue and say, fat tissue, you have been told to grow. I'm going to tell you how to grow, and that's specifically through hypertrophy. Now, insulin does that too. Insulin will also selectively promote hypertrophy, but linoleic acid contributes to that. So this is another unique mechanism whereby it contributes to insulin resistance by selectively influencing the way the body gains fat. All right, that is it. Let's now, thanks for listening. Hopefully you took some notes. And again, that talk that I referred to, shrinking the fat cells, insulin versus energy, that's one that will get posted here soon and you will really enjoy it. You'll like it. It's really me diving into these last points that I was just talking about, namely taking the big fat cell and shrinking it. All right, let's move over to the Q&A.